Drink talking. He sits alone, nursed in a warm, murky pint, occasionally glancing at others who held company and shared a joke. He even silently took part in their conversations and ached with a sick longing to belong to the next round. Once he too had been a vital flagstone in the drinking house, there was never a pint drank apart, a smoke toked, or a party attended that he did not partake in. Freshmen tagged at his heels, and tall women with long legs enjoyed his wit, his wisdom, and sometimes his bed. Maybe if he ordered another pint, someone might strike up a conversation at the bar. Christ, even the barman's an unsociable bastard. There's no Marx nor Lenin debated on high stools here, just pseudo conversations from first year college students who wouldn't know the politics of Castro from Reagan. And where are the friends who share the crack and wandered from Listoon to Kenmare with nothing but a nudge and 20 quid in their pockets? The bikers, the beatniks, the spacers, the no placers. All for one and one for all down the stream. Sometimes a college kid was subjected to drunken truths, half-told truths, and truths half-told. But Jesus, he thought to himself, wasn't that the secret of a good shagging story?
Sandra. Next we have Richard Keane.
This poem is about something we've all experienced, I think. It's procrastination. We've all had a dose of it in some level or other. And what I like about the poem is not its kind of literary content, but the fact that I did it in one sitting, which is kind of ironic, you know. Castrated by procrastination. Thoughts. Intended action. Coming. Later. Critical self-reflection in process. What kind of man are you? I hear a parental voice echoing somewhere in the cavernous recesses of my brain. A man in waiting for cause or country to serve soon.
The next up to the mic we have Rosie O'Regan.
I'm going to do one by Carl Ann Duffy, because I did a workshop recently. I'm going to leave that away, man. So I'm an actor, and I need to use my voice more. And anyway, the workshop, he was saying, you know, if you're a writer, you write every day. If you're a dancer, you have to fucking dance every day. And he says, fucking actors, you know. They arrive into the rehearsal room, and they're like, we haven't even read the fucking play yet. You know? He said, you have to work every day, so you should be learning stuff, you know, every day. So I thought, I'm going to learn a poem. So I learned one of Carl Ann Duffy's, and I think after tonight I will be learning Rita Anakin this week.
Good one.
I hope I can remember this, and it's called Music, and it's by Carl Ann Duffy. You think they cried, the children who followed the piper when the rock closed behind them forever, or cried never, happy to dance to the music. Happy to dance to his tune, lost in the music. And the lame boy, pressing his ear to blocked stone, to carry an echo home in his head, did he weep alone, the melody gone? Tell me, who hasn't tossed a coin in a hash for the busker on blue harmonica, heartbreak in the rain, or stood in the square with the students there, cheek violins gleaming under their chins, the Bach double clapped by pigeons, or smiled at the ragged choir rattling their tins. What's music the food of? Send over a beer to the bow-tied piano man to play it again. A child's fingers resting on the keys, opening a scale like a toy of sound. And who hasn't lifted the lid to pick at a tune with a fingertip? Perfect Day, Danny Boy, for a lease, recalling a name, a kiss, the breath or lip shared unsung song. When the light's gone, it's what the dying choose, the music we use at funerals, psalms listed in Roman numerals, solo, soprano, singing to a grave, sometimes the pipes, a harp. Do you think music hath charms? Do you think it hears and heals our hearts? Gord Mula.
Thank you, Rosie. Next we have Joe Sweeney.
Crave your indulgence for the last bit of this story. Imagine an upper class Englishman, a bit tipsy, reminiscing about a great house in Hampton Square and all the extraordinary guests they had, all fictitious. You may hear guests like Agatha Grizzly and her famous creation Herpes Poirot. Anyway, we'll just flash on. Lots of literary connections, our family. What a family, the ties that bind, well, handcuffs more like. infernal chains, more than ties, really. Now, Mary Matilda, I think it was, or was it Ballyhoo Belinda? I can't remember. Two aunts of mine, don't you know, we lived in terror of them. They used to go on seasonal trawls of London in their heyday, netting all sorts of queer fish, crustaceans and cuttlefish and conmen and celebrities, and that's only the seas. Anyway, one time they arrived home with, guess who? None other than the crime writer, Agatha Grizzly. She was a bit blown about, Agatha, rack and ruin, you know, but as it happened, at that time, there was a man staying with us, a Belgian eccentric called Herpes Borat, who went on to inspire one of Grizzly's great creations too. Now, Agatha took a shine to Herpes, and vice versa, and we're talking vice here too, big time. The police were scouring the country for her, and all the time she was with Herpes. Now, Herpes was a great storyteller. That's why we had him to stay so often. Great entertainer. First-class liar. He told stories of crimes, fictions we assumed, but we wondered. He gave such convincing details. Agatha was besotted with him and took him at face value. To her, he could do no wrong. He regaled us many an evening with accounts of the scores of murders which had stumped the police, but which he, single-handedly, by using his grey cells, had managed to sort out. We were frankly suspicious that he always seemed to be on hand when murders were committed. We asked him about this, and he gave an evasive answer, something about it being part of his genius, like his moustache. Well, we listened enthralled at his explanations of the crimes, but on the whole, they seemed to be so far-fetched that Priscilla and I, that's her ladyship, Priscilla Curtle Rislington, began to suspect something fishy, and we aren't talking plankton or minnow here, but great whoppers, whales. In a word, we began to suspect that Herpes Poirot had, in fact, killed all the people himself. The man was a serial killer before the term was even invented, excluding people like Adolf and Vlad and Mao and so forth. Now, Agatha Grizzly, however, never seemed to see through Herpes. She believed in him to the end. He was quite ingenious, really, when you come to think of it, passing himself off as a great sleuth like that, leading the police down the garden path again and again, incriminating innocent people, bamboozling them until they eventually confessed to crimes they had never committed and were led off in handcuffs. The man was a hypnotist, magnetic personality, a bit of a modern Rasputin. Just think the roguish cunning of him, getting away scot-free with all those murders. Lucky he liked us and never killed anyone in Hampton Square. I should think not, after all the gracious hospitality we showed him, setting him up with Agatha and two scullery maids before she came. But things began to go pear-shaped towards the end of our association with Herpes. The police were beginning to suspect him. I remember the last night he ever stayed with us back in 63. Herpes was in a big four-poster bed with Agatha and at least three of the servants, and not all female either. Being treated like royalty he was, cock of the walk, his every whim being kowtowed to, and next minute the police are banging on the door. My man Jiffy excelled as usual, wonderfully unflappable, don't you know, ace in a crisis. He sauntered to the door on tiptoes as if butter wouldn't melt in his mouth, which it wouldn't. Now, Jiffy is a way of walking that creates a kind of rarefied atmosphere, like he's in a museum or a library, and callers very often feel they should talk in reverent whispers. He delayed the police with alcohol, at first his usual ploy, then with entertaining conversation. Finally, when they were getting restless, he ingeniously dressed up in a grass skirt, painted his lips, and did a West Indian dance, so as to give Herpes time to leg it stark naked out the back door, over the wall, never to be seen again. That was the zenith at number 19 Hampton Square. Nothing ever topped that. The police never came very often after that. they didn't trust themselves. Things are much quieter these days. We live in the country. Had to let the old place on Hampton Square go. Had some bad luck with shares in the 70s. Divided up into apartments now for professionals. Deadly dull, not a servant in sight. Sad, really. But we landed on our feet here. We found an old pile, renamed it Dinkledale Manor, and got started up again the old tricks. You know, we liberals, we never say die. We've done our bit over the years, I dare say, to bring this part of the countryside to life. No doubt about it. Lots of animals, too, even wilder in many ways than the good old days in Hampton. The old Colonel Rislington blood, you see, always up, up and at them, that's what I say. Only have four servants now. Jiffy's still with us, that's the most important thing. Still, four's a bit of a squeeze, especially in the one bed, but we know how to rough it when we have to. We Colonel Rislingtons. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. Next we have Joe Healy. Joe Healy.
Before I start, a short advertisement. We have a book published in Limerick from it's called Sextet, and six of us have been in it, and there'll be two of us here on the 30th of April as Paul's guests, Sheila Fitzpatrick O'Donnell and myself. And we're in Innes at the Glore session on next Saturday at 2 o'clock. So just a bit of advertisement, thanks. This poem is called I Held a Kalashnikov. I Held a Kalashnikov. I was your willing weapon of the masses for justice, hope, liberty, all mass-produced. We first met at the Florida arms dealer near his green, slimy alligator swamp. Knew we were in deep when we guarded drug shipments in St. Lucia. Raided banks in Paris, got hot and sticky by Spanish eyes as policemen died. Froze and damp sought our Maya hedges where we took out army checkpoints. But then you cradled me to your shoulder, pointed me in the right direction, laid me in a bunker, oiled and greased, off the streets, decommissioned. We have left our mark on the world. So sleep, my friend, sleep tonight.
Thanks, Joe. Next we have James Foley.
It's called in a Dogon village. Dogon is a region in Mali. On a January night, with a starfield sky, I found myself surrounded by boulders, cliffs, and trees. This was a foreign land, but I felt no danger here. A warm breeze blew in from the plain. With it, it brought secrets not understood by Western ears. But to the telling spirits of the cliffs, the language was clear. Shadows roamed through the steep stone winding paths under the three-quarter moon. As the day came to a close in this ominous village, light sparkled in the children's eyes. With no TVs or consoles to kill their time, happily and free, they sat in a circle around the fire. Their parents did not fret. Worry has a different meaning here.
Thank you, James. Next to the mic we have Tom Maloney.
My poem is self-explanatory. It's called Let Them Eat Cake on the Internet. Did anyone catch the dowser offering vinegar in a sponge in between playing the Joker against amongst the pack at the forum? And who heard Paddy heckle the foreigner about a so-called need to tighten up? And why couldn't the screws on the cross hold a good man back when he wished to keep his promise on Sunday morning? And who set up the latest measure to pass for the foreigner? Answers come in tongues of the glib. They tap into the flow of great natural gas. Multinational workers in the interest of fair play and for old time's sake. But someone refers surely to the Old Testament, therein the wisdom of Abraham, the coming of the Messiah. At least when the weekend comes and natural disasters fill the news, ask historians about the hungry 30s. Choreograph the hecklers to look up the French Revolution. A day of riot, make special arrangements with local bakeries still in business to put a black and white picture, for effect, of Maria Antoinette on the current cakes. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. And next, up to the mic, we have Aidan O'Shea, our five-word champion.
This is called King Size. King Size. I'm 6 feet two in height, and you were 5 feet nine. We fitted snugly together, eye to eye and cheek to cheek. Our marriage bed was a thing of wonder, made to order. King Size, they called it, with a header and footer of cherry wood inlay on dark mahogany. It measures 7 feet long by 5 feet wide. So, when we moved into this house, the baseboard had to be sawn in two and hinged to get around the acute angle of the stairs. We laughed ourselves silly at the bisected bed, and the carpenter blushed as he bolted it together again. As soon as he had left, we threw the mattress on top and dived in together in celebration, while the baby toddled around the bedroom, cooing. That was a sunny afternoon in 1971. Fast forward half a lifetime and some more. Today, I bought some pastel sheets, king size, stripped down the bed, and turned the mattress round. It struck me that tonight I shall lie on your side, in that gentle place of whispered words and plaited limbs, and when I lie in the shape of an S for sleep, will you stretch out from the next life and form a double S with me, lying snugly like spoons in a cutlery drawer, if only in the, my king-sized dream.
Thank you, Aidan. And next up we have Jennifer Matthews.
I'm such a fan of so many people in this room, I just have to say that. Okay. This is called The Messages. I'd like to write a series. I have a notion I'm going to write a series of poems about phrases that were new to me when I came to Ireland. So The Messages would be a new one for me. Would have been. Okay, The Messages. Minutia, like shopping for food, like new light bulbs for the hallways, like stamps, like settling debts, are running errands in Missouri, the littleness of daily life written on slips, things missing, careless omissions, pocket-sized annoyances when I could be doing more, solving, building, earning, converting. Aristide, the errata are giving meaning. You're doing the messages, the procurement of tea, its featherweight comfort, the crucial constants of bread and milk, and Grania chatting to you at the small shop while people queue, waiting patiently or not, but won't interrupt the duty of small talk. Delay is easily shaken. Even bus drivers on high streets stop both directions of traffic for the chat, schedules merely suggestions. The inconvenient crescendos softly in sighs and eye rolls of passengers, faces to watch faces, wiped free and clean by a look out the window, or a nudge from the old woman next to me to put down the book shield I've propped up to forget we're all in it. Now what do you think of the sweater we're getting?
Thank you, Janet. Next we have Seamus Harrington.
Thanks, Paul. I heard a piece on the radio one time by, I think it was Mona Gourke, and she spoke about just starting a reading and somebody dives at the microphone and starts adjusting. Rab came to the rescue tonight at the start of it. I know. It might have been on Sunday Miscellany, it's worth hearing. Anyway, this is 2-2. No. Go on, she whispers. Two pinpricks defy the beam of a million candle power, mesmerizing. Again, our seats on the roof are freezing. I reach forward to push the polystyrene across the windscreen. The high-pitched squeal gets to him. He darts straight for us, cowers once more. Yours. Her breath, a mist, tie, a furnace, resolve, pure steel. I take the lamp, umbilical to the dash, ease it towards me. Snow flurries in through the sunroof, down our legs, toe-poking the seats. We'd slept soundly last night, worse luck. I thought of the last two pairs of claws, scrabbling for purchase, yowls of terror. That was the final straw. Then the dawning, bird flu-like silence, a feather light ticking, tick-tick, from the cooling engine. Breathless, she steadies, clamping her feet around the driver's head rest. I don't recall starting to count 19, 20, safety catch 22, now. Thank you.
Thank you, Seamus. Next we have Patricia Walsh.
Thank you, Paul. So I'm dedicated to my father who died almost 3 years ago, and I don't want to be guilty of the dead, but he wasn't always the easiest person to get on with. It's called Dad's Cabinet. Fingers on the pulse without a quest. I'm still alive, so here we see the tableau of bedtime. Starting in the afternoon under these simultaneous equations of flesh and genes reduced to hankering at our embassies, which in a day would never have existed. What we've seen is a hard-wearing of comedies restricting our exports back and forth for reasons we do not want to understand. Thanks.
Thank you, Patricia. Next we have Margaret Sheehan.
The writer spoke of his father coldly, fires brimming in even tones. Hidden in bones beneath layers of skin and years, bearing nothing to the camera but a bold wisdom on every subject, except one. In stillness running, his face impassive. He writes great prose at his desk every evening, walks country lanes in search of happiness, sometimes finds it beneath great oaks and acorns falling not far from the tree, a certain violence in the silence of memory. Thank you.
Thanks, Margaret. Next we have Mary O'Connell.
Thanks, Paul. This is called Sweat Lodge. Usually they're a part of a ritual of the Native Americans, but I was at a sweat lodge in Bantry, and this poem came out of that. I am held by entwining branches, the sun warm on my back. I move up higher, push into a cavity of leaves, start to strip the bark. a work of preparation, each group a different task. All of us are fasting. Some bend cut branches into shape, fashioning the skeleton of a yurt. Others search for stones that must be round and flat to heave into the flames, then settle in a hollow on the ground. Still more roll out sheets of black tarpaulin to clothe the frame of wood. We are the moss gatherers. We cover all with lichen. By the torrent, some are drumming, some are dancing, others singing. As the chant grows louder, we fall under its spell. Men move in an outer circle. Women form their own within. We disrobe and are the first to move into the makeshift tent. A woman wise in tribal lore leads us into darkness. Her incantation thrills me. She sprinkles water on the burning stones. The blast dries up my throat. As we hunker on the ground, I, wedged between two others, start to bake like bread until the pores release and sweat crawls down my limbs. The healer calls for courage to help us to endure. The men outside keep chanting to give us strength and hope as we gulp the blistering heat. We huddle in the womb-like space, slippery and speechless. But when I follow others and walk into the outside world, I'm dazzled by the daylight. I stumble to the waterfall and plunge into its foam. The icy liquid stops my breath and pins me to the rock. Surfacing, I lie upon my back to let the swirling motion carry me along. Never so wide with wonder, never so cleansed and clean, I wake up to the now. Thank you.
And next we have Mike Gallagher.
Okay, just sitting down again. Last year I was invited to Dublin to celebrate the life of one of our more illustrious poets, and I was just overwhelmed by the galaxy of stars and by their wit and wisdom. I got back to Lyra Campana and I had to think about it, and I wrote this sonnet. Instinct. A solemn gathering. The earnest poets, philosophers and theologians, versed in weft of word and erudite discourse, the rudiments of life and death obsessed. Pet theories trashed, pet propositions flashed, fresh theses so politely sent to bed, old certainties dispatched with such panache, and yet was aught of import really said. The more that we are shown, the less we see. Nothing within our ken is absolute. Reason is but license to disagree. Good man has known for long his utmost truth. Just like the ass, the ape, the stupid fly, survive to sally forth and multiply. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. And next we have Miles Herriot.
This is called Apocalypse, No Thanks. And it was inspired or triggered by a line from a Nick Cage song, which goes something like, I don't believe in an interventionist God. Before I read it, I just want to quote four people. A U.S. preacher, fundamentalist preacher, You know, if we end up having to pull our troops out of Iraq, that means that their Allah is greater than our Jehovah. That's number one. Al-Qaeda spokesman. This is a jihad to make the word of Allah supreme in the world. Next one. President Obama. I have a policy to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. I will not hesitate to use force. The last one is, we would like to see Israel wiped off the face of the earth. That's the head of the Iranian government, Ahmadinejad. Apocalypse, no thanks. When will I bless the world, says God, besieged by the battered human race? When each befuddled human clod stops fearing and hating the foreign face, then will I bless the world, says God. Have a heart, don't blame me, says God. Your religions and isms are all a cod until you learn to let go of rage. You righteous are a pain in the arse, says God. Just grow up, clerics and politicians, and act your age. Give me a break, don't blame me, says God. To beat your backs, you make the rod. Look within to meet the source. I am Jehovah, Allah, Shiva, says God. Want apocalypse? Ride on course. Count me out, don't blame me, says God. Thanks.
Thank you, Niall. Next we have Ruslan Bloom.
Much. It's another very serious one. I was looking back at my studies about modernism and kind of tried to sum it up, and this is what I came up with. It kind of came in German first, but I'm just going to read the translation. Ultra-modernity. O world of modern times, mindlessly uprooted, homo progressivus, feet are off the ground. Always out of breath, unswervingly pathless, shattered by velocity to the power of infinity. We're disintegrated by the speed of progress, frantically entangled in the data craze excess. Homeless is the mind from heaven detached, dredging the gloom in the woe of solitude, with no light and wisdom ruthlessly unlatched, feeble and confused, in its quest to thrive. Homo rationalis, to blame for segregation, the root of abjuration, inactivating life. All is out of place when the heart is unheard, blindness of history as greed rules the world. So far from one another, hard and cold to earth, what we do unto us and every other being, we react like victims, dispossessed and homeless. And our divided downfall is abysmal, boundless. How will this twisted raging in the world resolve if we won't make a turn for ourselves to evolve?
Thank you, Sue. And Pater has allowed us for four more poets. And next we have Cal Doyle.
Lines for John Berryman. As a child, my mother sang songs to me. You'd marry girls young enough to be your daughters. I swear to you that there are ghosts in blackface, vaudevillains today tossing lines beneath a broken tent. Child wrote stories on an electric typewriter. You just don't know a man until you see him cry. Do I still arrive in the middle of the night? You need an activity boy, like drinking, to break in the evening. Here in Dublin, I wrote 50. No, I destroyed 50 of them here. No, I forget. could have been a cottage somewhere out west. 16 years before you were even born. Thanks.
This girl, and next we have Colm Scully.
I was actually going to read a different poem when I came in, but I'll just say this one now. It's just about, you know, when sometimes parents can try to live out their own dreams through their children. They'll try to live their lives through children too, those sons and daughters of those rainy days, when all they heard was mother calling guilt. You want to be a doctor, don't you, love? Well, stay upstairs. They hated every minute of their youth. The plaintive cries, I gave my life to the kids. Your father works till half past ten so you might be the things we dreamed of for ourselves. You'll never have to answer to your peers or cycle home from work for 20 years. And when they failed their first exam in maths and felt the deep resentment in them swell, they swore as long as they could lift a shovel, they'd never let their children go through hell. But in the mellowing of their summer's quest, as rates grew lower for the labouring man, they dreamt a better future for their sons. They had a plan.
Ms. Cullen. Reb Urquhart.
Resident Perth family. Anyway. Translated from the Sanskrit and found at the site of the ancient city of Nineveh, written on a pottery shard circa 514 BC. And people didn't really know people, you know. It was very awkward and uncomfortable. Millie was stressed and left early without letting me know. And James sailed through the whole thing, oblivious. Such was the carpet to the curtain of the night.